die, Father, is nothing left. Ever since I was a child, I had a feeling that something is missing me. I want to know why I'm here. Can any of us know that? Become yourself. Then God and the devil don't mess. I want to learn. I want to understand. Be careful. Can you find the force to enable these two quite opposite lines to live together in your soul? At any moment, the wolf can devour the lamb. And you must learn what it means to become responsible. This is an exact science. And that is why you are here.
Folks, welcome back. This is Red Ice Radio, and our website is redicecreations.com. Today we're talking with Danish scientist Niels Harrit about the anomalies with the collapse of the World Trade Center towers, including Building 7, and the paper active thermitic material discovered in dust from the 9/11 World Trade Center catastrophe. Hi, Niels. Thank you for coming on the program, first of all. I hope all is well with you and yours in Denmark, just south of us here in Sweden.
Hello, Henrik, and thank you for taking me on. Yeah, we're fine in Denmark. Spring has just come, and the weather is acceptable, and I'm looking out on all the green stuff which is coming out right now.
Well, that's nice. It's always good when that time of year comes around, since we're way up there in the north, so I hear you for sure. Now, you're an associate professor at the Department of Chemistry at Copenhagen University. Why don't we just talk a little bit about your academic background for our audience that might not be familiar with you or your work, so we know who we're talking with here. Yes.
Well, I'm retired now, but I consider myself emeritus because I still have a little corner. I still have my desk and all my books at the university. But just recently I had to leave my office for space reasons. But I'm still at the university, still have some projects ongoing and students who are launching their careers. And so I'm retired associate professor of chemistry at the University of Copenhagen, where I started as a student in 1963. Right now I'm 68 years old, and I got the usual academic career, nothing special in that, got a PhD. Was traveling and in Germany and the United States, and came back and got a position, and have been teaching chemistry for more than 40 years on all levels at the university. That is producing master degrees and PhDs, and I don't count them because we didn't do that in my generation. My specialty, if there is any, that is chemical reactions with light. Mm-hmm. I'm a photochemist, but on the physical side. So in the end of my career at the university, I was actually sitting at the physics department at the Niels Bohr Institute, working with physicists on, well, now it becomes a little technical, time-resolved X-ray scattering on very short time scales. That is, we were looking at chemical reactions on time scales of 1 millionth or 1 millionth of a second. This is very, very fast. Actually, this is the onset of chemistry. It does not get any faster. So we are on a time scale where the nuclei are moving. That is very, very fast. So this is about what I know what I know something really about. But my education, I'm from a generation where the education was very broad. So I have a profound and basic knowledge of physics and chemistry, which makes it possible for me actually to understand most things which is going on in the physical world. And this is the basic training of a good natural scientist, that is that he or she has an intuitive urge to understand what's going on. And I mention this because it represents my kickoff in the 9/11 truth movement, because I was watching Building 7.
Yeah.
Now, in 2006, I saw it accidentally on a DVD, and immediately I was in conflict with this instinct which I've just told you about. I couldn't understand why this building suddenly collapsed. That's for once. And yeah. The other thing which we may talk about also is that I was deeply offended that, as I understood, this was World Trade Center. And those who decide what I was supposed to know had decided that I was not supposed to know that there were two airliners with three skyscrapers. So these were two obstacles which made me think. And in a couple of weeks, it takes time. When you see Building 7 for the first time, it's such a huge actual revelation, it takes time to digest, and we can talk about that as well. But in a couple of weeks, I understood that this, what I had seen, maybe probably was just part of the biggest event in my lifetime. And due to this urge, itch, you may say, as a natural scientist to find out what was going on, I had to take a closer look. And this I've been doing ever since, and it should be no secret that the more you look into it, the worse it gets.
Yeah. Well, that is the truth, isn't it?
Uh-huh.
Wow. So your interest obviously is at the background to all of this. Now, so what's the interface between your science and this interest of yours, then? When at some point along the road did you get access to some of the material that we're going to talk about here?
You mean physically material, you're talking about the dust?
Yes.
Or that much later on. Actually, in the beginning, it was very basic. You know, the free fall acceleration of Building 7 is so fundamental. And maybe we should spend a little time on that, because that story is also relevant for the Swedes in the following sense. When I'm giving many presentations on World Trade Center, I think I've passed 170 points now.
Yeah.
And some of them are in high schools. And the story I tell there is special, because the beauty of the free fall of Building 7, or if you could put it that way, is that it actually connects with the very first experiments ever performed in the history of natural science. And you can even go further back to that as a Swede, and I could point to the fact that out in the Sund here, between Denmark and Sweden, there's a little island called Ven, which around the change between the 16th and 17th century were actually Danish, and there was a scientist living there, not a real scientist, but he was the first one. His name was Tycho Brahe, and he was the first one to make observations. And it may sound trivial, but that is basically what it's all about, that you sit down and take a look. And if you dare to believe what you see. And the story goes from him to Galileo Galilei, who was living in Italy. Actually, he was professor of mathematics in Pisa from 1589 to 1592. And when he was fired, actually, but he stayed in Pisa And here it comes. He was doing experiments. These are the very first experiments, systematic experiments conducted in natural science. He was throwing objects out from the tilting tower in Pisa while the whole city was watching, and all the clergymen and the priests and the bishops and the novices were watching. He was throwing objects out from the tower, and these systematic experiments resulted in two laws about gravitation. The first one is that all objects are falling at the same speed, which we should not comment on. But the other one is dealing with free fall. Yeah. And he provided actually the formula for the relationship between the distance of a free fall and the elapsed time. If I may be a little technical, it is so that the distance is proportional to the time squared. And now this is in 1593. And this is basically these experiments which later led into Sir Isaac Newton's very famous book in 1687. And so the basic rules or the laws for concluding that Building 7 was a controlled demolition actually goes back to the birth of natural science. And the story, which I will not go into further detail, is so beautiful, particularly for college students. And there's a lesson here, because as you may know, Galilei, he really paid a price for his research, not relating to the gravitational experiments, but you know, he was in 1633, he was taken in by the Inquisition. Actually, he had written a book. He was asked by the church to write a book about how the world was made up. And in that book, he wrote that the sun was in the center of the planetary system and the earth was orbiting around it. And this was not common knowledge. It was not accepted by the church at that time. They wanted the Peter Square in Rome to be the center of the universe. So it was taken up very badly. And he was taken into custody for 4 months. And we don't know exactly what happened during these 4 months. But it's reasonable. It's to suppose that he was subjected to what we these days will call enhanced interrogation techniques.
Torture.
At least, at least at the session where, and in the meantime, actually, he turned 70. This was an old man. And you can see from the pictures that he was in pain. But at the session, the torture instruments were standing in a corner to make sure that he should not skip in the last second. And he was forced down on his knees to swear that the earth was in the center of the universe and that it was standing still. Now, it is unrelated to 9/11, but the lesson from that story is that telling the truth has a price.
Yeah.
And some people have paid much larger prices for doing that these days than you and I have so far. But it has a price which you pay in particularly and most notably on the social level. Maybe we can come back to that. But that is the story which, and then of course we take up Newton and Galilei when I'm talking to the college students, and we go back to World Trade Center Building 7, and now we have the tools to talk about freefall acceleration, courtesy Galileo and Isaac Newton.
Very good.
It's a beautiful story.
Now, yeah. What I was curious about that. What types of schools invite you, and are they okay with this, the theories or ideas that you present?
Oh yeah. Of course, the teacher has to come. comply with it.
Right.
And it is from...
I'm surprised they're allowed. That's what I'm saying.
From the ninth grade and upwards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I'm very ambivalent actually with doing this, and I think it's very difficult because this is deep shit, man. And what I'm saying is basically that those who you should trust, those who are taking care of you, have lied to you.
Well, that's a good way to talk about it.
Yeah, and in a sense, you know, and to young people who are on the verge of their life, and now here comes life, and now we're going on and we're going to conquer the world. This is heavy, man.
Sure.
So, but on the other hand, we have to face the truth because it's their destiny, it's their life. And so we have to face the truth if that's what it is.
Yep.
So, and that is why I wrap the truth up in this, which I think is this fantastic story about Galileo and Newton, and very exciting. There are other people involved as well in that story, and we concentrate exclusively on the free fall of Building 7, and then of course I bring in David Chandler, the American college teacher, brilliant teacher who has done so many videos, which tells everything so clearly. But the teachers are happy because Building 7 is a brilliant object for teaching Newton's laws. So you can actually use it straight away for projects. And each year when it's time, I know for the schools to make these projects, I get plenty of inquiries of kids calling me in and asking about this and that. And I always try to help. And the grades they get are either zero or top. I mean, and this really, excuse my French, pisses me off when a teacher, because they're doing a brilliant work, but then they get a zero. Because the teacher can simply not comprehend it.
Sure,
it's
yeah.
too much. But yeah. The teacher, it's too painful for the teacher. But other teachers give the proper credits to these kids who has the courage to see for themselves, and that is the point, the message of the talks I'm giving in the schools. See what you see, and not what you're supposed to see. And this is much more fundamental than most people think of.
Yeah.
It's deep.
Yeah.
It's deep. It's really deep. Because it hurts. The truth hurts, but the lies are killing us.
Yeah, you're right. That's right. Now, is there something more you want to say just about Building 7 overall? This is something, obviously, that you watched through observation, as you said, through video material and just realizing what happened. And this is how you began to put the pieces together here of the puzzle, if you will. I do want to get on to as well and just talk about when you get involved more in the papers that you wrote together with a bunch of other people on active thermitic material and all that. But is there anything more you want to say about Building 7 before we move on?
Well, no. It's key. It's key, in my opinion, far more actually than the red gray chips are. Because everybody, once you have seen Building 7, there is no way back. You can cheat on yourself, and you can try to suppress it, but you cannot. You have seen it, and then there is no way back. It's not very healthy, you know, to lie to yourself and say, "No, I didn't see that." Yeah, but many people do because it's simply too painful. So I think we have passed, we can talk about that later eventually, we have passed the point of documentation. Now it's about information. And that Building 7 is the greatest vehicle, tool. And that's why my presentation is, I spent most time on controlled demolitions, also about the towers and the nanothermite is a footnote. In the sense that you have to see it in the full picture to actually understand where it eventually fits in.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's not crucial. It's not. Many people think that it is a standalone piece of forensic evidence, which it is. It is not. It should be seen in a context to be appreciated. But we can talk, we can move to that on if you wish now.
Okay, well, it doesn't matter. I mean, wherever you feel is pertinent to kind of lay it out for our audience, you can definitely spend more time on the controlled demolition. I mean, at some point as well, I want to ask you about what this means, obviously, and what the conclusions are that you've come to. What is the result of what it is that we're seeing in front of us? And either we can go into that now, or if you want to talk about something else, Niels, what do you think?
Let me tell you a story about the retrograde ships then. We were in 2006. I had discovered Building 7. Actually, this was a presentation given by Professor Stephen E. Jones from Brigham Young University in Utah. The video my wife and I came across in late 2006. And over the next couple of months, we looked in further into it, and I realized that it was payback time for me as a scientist. You know, the society has paid my education and my salary for so many years, and I believed I understood in physical and chemical way what was happening, so it was my duty to tell about it. So I wrote a little essay and submitted it for a paper, which I had never done before at that time, actually. And it was rejected, and eventually we had it printed, and then absolutely nothing happened, you know? Deep silence. I thought at that time, as an ordinary, naive citizen, that if you just jump up on the soapbox and you tell the truth to the world, everything will move on its own. I realized that it absolutely, nothing happened.
Right.
And it was published in a Danish newspaper about Building 7, and that's all there is. There were two airliners, but three skyscrapers. Hey, if you can count to three, there's something wrong here. Nothing happened. So I realized that I had to get together a presentation, which this is my trade, you know, giving lectures. And so I started doing that in the fall of 2007. And eventually I was in contact with Kevin Ryan and... I was reviewer of a paper which Kevin Ryan had submitted for a scientific journal. You know Kevin Ryan, he's a chemist and scientist and a truth activist. He's living in Bloomington, Indiana. And so I was a reviewer of a paper he submitted on the World Trade Center dust. Because, you know, there were very strange things happening in the month after 9/11. The pile kept burning until December the 20th. And the emissions of chemicals from ground zero over these 3 months, actually it continued into February, was flabbergasting, was stunning, and very strange. You know, on specific days there were virtually eruptions of chemicals coming out of the pile. I could drop names, you know, styrene, benzene, toluene, and one very strange chemical called 1,3-diphenylpropane, etc., etc. And this is all data from the Environment Department of EPA, Environment Protection Agency. These are official data, actually, which Kevin Ryan had acquired via so-called Freedom of Information Act request. And but personally, I was an independent, anonymous reviewer of this paper, which he submitted for a scientific journal called The Environmentalist. And I thought it was very interesting. And then maybe I should tell you about the review process in science, because the reviewer is by necessity anonymous. The authors do not know the reviewer. But of course the referee, which is the same thing as the reviewer, the referee knows the authors. So it happens once in a while, and I've done this a couple of times as a referee, that you find either the thing so interesting or you find it beneficial for everybody if you shortcut the review process and contact the authors directly and say, hey, it's much easier if you say, hey, if I have some problems with this and that, mm-hmm. and I may suggest this and that. So if you make these changes and resubmit the paper, you make my review process much easier, and we will get a faster flow through the editorial process.
Mm-hmm.
So I did that. So I contacted Kevin Ryan. It's a fantastic paper. It's very interesting about the chemistry going on in Ground Zero in the month after 9/11. It's really a bitch's brew of chemistry, and it took them 3 months to put out the fires. And this was not an ordinary fire. They were pouring water on it 24 hours a day. And they simply couldn't put it out. Now, but Kevin's paper was about this, and so I contacted him. So later on, independently, Stephen E. Jones had begun to look into the World Trade Center dust. He started in 2006, and during 2007, he also wrote a paper, actually, on the World Trade Center dusts too earlier on. And those were based on reports which had been published by a private company called the R.J. Lee Group in 2003, 2004, and later on a report by the United States Geological Survey in 2005. So there were early reports on the World Trade Center dust. And the findings in these reports implied unambiguously that there had been very, very high temperatures during the collapses of World Trade Center, the three buildings. I mean, there were findings in the dust from these completely independent reports, which implied temperatures beyond 3,000 degrees centigrade. And this, Professor Jones had written actually two papers about, and at some point he wondered if he was just, oh, we have to take a closer look on the dust. So he was requesting individuals, send out requests for individuals who may have dust samples.
Right.
So eventually, Professor Stephen Jones, he decided to take a look into the dust himself on the basis of these very early reports from the IGNE group and the Geological Survey. So during 2006 and 2007, he sent out on the web requests for individuals who were having samples of the World Trade Center dusts in their keeping, which he wanted to take a closer look at. And he got some samples. And he discovered eventually in the fall of 2007.
Stop right there. Let me just ask you this because that's interesting. Who had samples at the time? Who had access to that? Was this just random people who had actually collected it in New York, or was it official?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. As an example, there was a woman. Her name was Janet McKinley. She was living on the fourth floor at the corner of Liberty Street and Cedar Street. She actually had a view of the plaza. And when the South Tower collapsed, she were in a hurry to get away. So she took a wet towel around her neck and ran like crazy. And she was allowed to come back about a week later. And of course, her apartment was a complete mess. And there was a thick layer, 20 centimeters of dust all over.
Wow.
Now she had a spiritual mind. I'm talking about her in the past tense because she passed away, regrettably, 2 years ago from a brain tumor, which most people, including herself, blamed on her exposure to the World Trade Center dust. Talk a lot about this later.
Yep.
What was in the dust? And the first responders who suffered from that. But when she came back to her apartment, she saved some of the dust in a plastic bag. because he realized the apocalyptic aspect of the event. And she got a relationship with this dust. Also, you know, there were remains of human beings in it. I mean, this is deeply serious. And she was an artist, and she wanted to keep some of the dust, and she turned it into pieces of art later on, which she did. But it was stored in a dry and cool place, which is important. So the first sample which Professor Jones received was actually from Janet McKinley. And he put it under a microscope and took a look at it. And one of the things he saw first was some completely spherical, completely round particles, which was identified as iron. And this actually is a more important finding than the red-gray chips. Because to find complete spherical iron particles in the dust is on its own an unambiguous indication of the thermite had been applied during the controlled demolitions of the World Trade Center. Now, this is not a unique finding by Stephen E. Jones. This information you can find already in the 2003 report from the RJLE group, who reported a content of 5.87% of these iron spheres in the dust, which is an enormous number. So if you take a very strong magnet and you have the dust in a plastic bag, and you pull the magnet along the plastic bag, these spheres come along with the magnet, so they're very easily isolated by a magnet. Actually, the red-gray chips comes along too, because they have some magnetic properties as well. And so this observation alone implied the application of thermite. But Stones, and there are many other observations leading to the same conclusion, but Jones located some of these very, very small red-gray chips. This is he announced in December 2007 in Boston at a meeting there. And during early 2008, there was collected a little team of scientists. And because I had made connection with Kevin Ryan, the story I told you before, when I was referee on his paper earlier.
Was that just accidental, or did you specifically, you know, request to look at that paper, review it?
No, you are being requested.
Okay.
The referee has you are being requested by the journal.
I see. Yeah, and he knew of you by that point.
Yeah.
Yep. Okay.
Because I told you that because the essay that I published in early 2007 was actually translated into English by a Dane.
Oh, so okay.
Actually, he's Australian, but he's very good at it.
Okay.
And so he put that on the web in English, which as a consequence had Alan Miller, who at that time was running a web page called Patriots for 9/11 Truth, which was a very good paper, a very good website. He folded for different reasons later on, but he asked me if I would accept to be listed on that his web page, and I said yes. So that is and how I actually became known to the 9/11 community.
I see.
In the early 2008, there was established a little team of scientists, and I was asked to join. And I was actually very honored to be asked to join, because already at that time I considered Stephen E. Jones as a great hero, and he is a great man. But I also could see that I felt a gap actually on the team, because I'm working in nanotechnology on the Nanoscience Center, University of Copenhagen.
Yeah.
So I know a bit about nanoscience, and so I could play a role and make myself useful. And eventually, more or less, so we worked together on this. And it came out, when we had to write it up, it takes an awful lot of time to do these kind of things. And it was actually 18 months in the making, this paper. But eventually it was published on April the 3rd of 2009. And for different reasons, I ended up as first author on this paper. There were, maybe I should tell this story, because if so, there have been some misunderstandings in this.
Okay.
There are 9 authors on the paper. But when you decide who's supposed to be, who should be first author, there are many considerations which goes into that. Sometimes they're very fast, because if it's usually in the first author is the guy who did the work. And this is very often a PhD student. So the last author, which has the correspondence and which has, let's say, the star, who's the team leader, is the man with the project, with the ideas and the money. But now this paper was different, and we have to look at it differently, because the first author name carries the paper.
Right.
If you see, you very usual, you say Johnson et alia, and Johnson is just the first author. So we have to consider this. Now, at that time, actually, Professor Jones had a tense relationship with the Brigham Young University. But by and large, I must stress that I think he was treated very decently by the university. I mean, they had problems. And but we had access to their equipment, which was very good. They had a brilliantly equipped and brilliantly staffed. And Jeffrey Farrer is still working on the Brigham Young University. So we submitted, there were, on these 9 people, actually, I would say there were 4, eventually 5 of us who could have served as first author, because it is a responsibility. You had to respond to things. But there, several of us could have served as first author if necessary, because we have contributed equally to it. And so we submitted, actually, the paper for preview to Brigham Young University. Stephen Jones did that.
Yeah.
I mean, it is okay if we publish this. And they treated it fairly. You may imagine when there are 9 authors on a paper, there are different views on many.
Oh, sure.
And actually, some of the other guys wanted to give it more of an edge, if you take the meaning. My preference was to keep it strictly on scientific basis.
Right.
Scientific.
To get more papers in, or you know, more attention on this.
Yeah. We stick to the evidence and that's it. No, we should not go beyond the data. This is a key phrase. We should not go beyond the data.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But there were different opinions on that. But this was one of the objections that that the leadership of Brigham Young University actually insisted that we took this and that out. I was going along with it. And another thing, which I think is actually fair, they said an employee from Brigham Young University cannot serve as first author. Now, that left out some of the other guys and eventually left some of us behind. And now we're only 2 or 3 eventually left for consideration of first author. So for different reasons into which I'm not going to detail, and I took the duty of serving as first author. But I must stress that some of the other guys could have done that as well, because it was really a cooperation. And the contribution was quite evenly distributed, I would say.
Very good, yeah.
So that's the story of that. It is not, and most of the data, of the published data, the high quality data, the pictures which went into it, they were done on Brigham Young's instrument because they had such a brilliant instrument and because the operator there is very good. But the thinking and everything, I would say we are evenly contribute.
Right. Now, do you want to share with us then a little bit about some of the things that you do present in the paper and what basically, you know, we want to get to the consequences later on here, what this means, yeah. Of course, and everything. But yeah, tell us about the paper.
The key observation is that some of these chips are still reactive. And that is it. It's a very long paper. And there are many data going into it. But the key observation, and all you need, is that some of these chips are reactive. When you heat them up, they take off, and you form elemental iron in the process. And that is the thermite reaction, period. That's it.
Yeah.
And this is the fact that most critics actually do not touch upon. They talk about everything else, which is not decisive. The decisive observation is the formation of these very same iron spheres. You can reproduce the process in the laboratory. You heat them up and they react and you form the iron spheres, which are the same iron spheres which are found in abundance in the dust. So these two observations, I mean, they're not accidental.
Sure, right? Yeah.
Believe me. So, and that's it.
So what does the thermite actually do? How does it react? Let's talk about how it potentially was applied even, because people don't know this.
Well, we don't know, really. I mean, and this is what the paper is. We have found these chips. They are still reactive. They form elemental iron, and they shouldn't be there.
But
that's
they are.
That's a lesson.
Yeah.
But when you start looking to all the other evidence, and that's why I said some time ago that the findings of the red-grade chips should really be seen in the context.
It's additional to everything else.
Yeah, it should be seen together with all the other observations which imply the application of thermite. Let me tell you a little bit about thermite. Thermite, the classical thermite reaction, dates back to 1893 when a German chemist called Hans Goldschmidt discovered that when you mix a fine divided aluminum with final divided, say, rust or iron oxide.
Yeah.
But you may say rust particles. These two powders, when you mix them together, if you can make them react, you get a very, very violent reaction, out of which comes elemental iron, molten iron, at a temperature of 2,500 degrees centigrade, which is roughly 1,000 degrees above the melting point of iron and steel. And this reaction is very useful because it can be used for welding. And it's been used for welding since 1899, when it was used for the first time for this purpose. But it can also be used for military purposes because this very, very hot molten iron coming out of the reaction can be used to destroy armor. So the thermite reaction has been used in grenades and torpedoes for decades, since World War I. But it must be stressed that the old-fashioned thermite is not an explosive. Its destructive power is based on heat, while an explosive works by means of force.
Yeah.
An explosive is a chemical substance which reacts very fast and produces a gas and a pressure and knocks things over like you're being hit with a karate hit.
Yeah.
So you blow things apart, while the classical, the conventional, the old-time thermite works by means of heat. Now, if you mix into this thermite, and the thermite reaction comes in many, many different varieties, and actually the cave busters, which have just been shipped off to Israel, is also based on the same thermite reaction, not with iron oxide, but a variety of it. It can be used for many military purposes because it burns its way through concrete, for example. But if you mix into the thermite mixture sulfur and eventually a substance called barium nitrate, you get what the in the military is called third mate. And please notice the difference between third mate and third mate.
Yeah.
In the third mate mixture, you have sulfur. And if you, and that mixture, by virtue of the sulfur, is cutting through steel like a hot knife is cutting through butter. And it, then we had to, I had to point to a direction on an, another investigation done by Jonathan Barnett from the Worcester Institute of Technology. And this was published already in the late 2001, early 2002. And they had actually had some steel beams from FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, for inspection. Because FEMA, who conducted the preliminary investigation into the collapses of World Trade Center, they gave these steel beams to these researchers, and who are metallurgists, that is, they know about metals and stuff. And what they found was sulfidation of the steel. That is, they found chemical substances in the steel, in the corroded steel, because some of these steel beams look like Swiss cheese.
Yeah.
And their edges, they're thin like razor blades.
Yeah.
And edges which is cutting off. So when you look at these steel beams, you found intergranular sulfidation of the steel. That is, you're finding chemical compounds called iron sulfide and iron oxide, which unambiguously imply that these beams has been cut by the application of thermate. That is, that you're cutting the steel, the columns of World Trade Center prior to the collapses, weakening the whole structure by thermate.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the retrograde ships cannot account for this finding. We do not find sulfur. So, which means that we are... So now in a situation, also if you take a look at the physical cause of the collapses, if we take Building 7 first. Now, it, as you may know, and some of your listeners probably know, Building 7 came down in free fall.
Yeah.
Free fall acceleration for 2.3 seconds. And courtesy, Galileo Galilei, as Sir Isaac Newton, this is a completely... There's no way around this observation, which implies that Building 7 was a controlled demolition, because when an object comes down in free fall, all the energy, the potential energy of the object is used for accelerating the object. There is no energy left for, in this case, bending and ripping apart hundreds, thousands of steel beams in the building.
That would take too much time.
There's no energy for it.
Yeah.
It's not even a matter of time.
Right.
There's simply no energy for taking down the building when the top comes down in free fall.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
It's so fundamental. And it comes down in free fall actually right on the pot. It comes down with an acceleration of 9.88 meters per second squared, which actually is a little above the free acceleration form. But this is just Manhattan or insecurities in the measurement. It's not important. But there's no way around this. And this can only be accomplished if at the moment of when it starts to fall, all the structural elements of the building has been eliminated.
Yeah.
And since you see the whole building coming down completely symmetrically, it means that all the columns in the building at that time must have been taken out. Not necessarily at the same time. And my scenario is that you weaken the building prior to the final blow, and this was done by thermite. Thermate, you're cutting a great number of the columns, and until the building is just standing. But the very last moments, you have to bring in the explosives to achieve what you see, namely that the building is coming down symmetrically. The last fraction of the columns must be taken down within milliseconds. Very, very accurate timing of these explosive events is the condition for seeing what you see. So there is no way around the conclusion that explosives were used for taking down Building 7.
Let me ask you this. In a controlled demolition, do you know if thermite is usually used as well to weaken the structure beforehand?
No, it's not.
Okay.
You don't... We do not know. Well, yes and no. I mean, this is an often referred to question. Do we know of other controlled demolitions where thermite has been used?
Right.
And usually I answer no, but it turns out that during the 30s there was in Chicago two gigantic steel towers which had to be demolished, and for some strange reason, one of the tower, but these were open structures, these were not high rises, this was not skyscrapers, but these were two very tall towers, and for some reason, maybe because they wanted to practice, they took down one tower by explosives and the other one with the thermite. But this is the only, to my knowledge, the only known occasion when thermite has been used in controlled demolitions. Because when demolition companies are taking down buildings, they're doing it in the most economical way. So ordinary controlled demolitions do not come down in free fall. Obviously, because the demolition companies, they want to have gravity do as much work as possible.
Yeah, that's right.
Meaning that they want to do, and explosives are expensive. So they're using the minimum of explosives in ordinary controlled demolitions. And I'm not aware that thermite or thermite has been used for that specific purpose, taking down a high-riser, which is very rare, by the way.
Yeah.
But in the case of World Trade Center, what you're seeing in Bill, and imagine these engineers at work. I mean, you had to take down three high-risers while there was 1 billion people watching in real time, and you had to do it in a way that nobody should notice. There were no rehearsals. There were no reruns. I mean, what would you do? You would throw in 50% overcapacity, because there was no, this had to, there was
no failure second chance here. Yeah.
There were no reruns. There were no rehearsals. A failure was not an option.
Right.
So you would throw in an overcapacity of the explosives, and this is what you see.
Yeah.
You see Building 7 coming down in free fall. Everything, and we're talking about the core columns, a number of 24, various 30 core columns in Building 7, and 57 perimeter to columns, all where they are. All these have to be eliminated when the building starts moving. I'm not saying that they are all being eliminated at the same time, but the last wave had to be symmetrical. And only explosives can do that.
Mm-hmm.
So this, so much for Building 7. Now, talking about the towers, if you care to watch, if you care to look. Now, the very first, actually, video evidence of the collapse of the South Tower, as you may know, came down first. It was hit the last, but it came down first after 56 minutes. This is a reporter, I think he's from CBS. He's saying, this is as close as we can get to the World Trade Center. He's talking about the firemen assembled here, and then the camera looked up, and the commentator says, there's a huge explosion, I've got to get out of here. These are the first comments. There's a huge explosion. And what you see, basically, is the South Tower exploding from the top down. If you care to look, go back and take a look. And with the... And I urge you to remember that gravity is a downward force. According to official narrative, the Twin Towers came down due to gravity after having been weakened by the fires and the jetliners. Okay, mm-hmm. This is not correct, yeah. But when they came down to gravity only. Now, gravity moved downwards. But what you are seeing is the towers being blown up from the top down. And you see girders and steel beams weighing from 4 to 15 tons being hurled up and out in distances of 100 meters, 200 meters. This is a display of force. And it is moving upwards and outwards. This is not gravity. It's just simply to look and dare to look. So now we return what I said in the start of this interview. Just watch and believe what you're seeing, and the case is settled.
Yeah.
This is not gravity. Because simply the force hurls the steel beams and the girders up and out. And that's it. Now, these are explosives, we do not know the nature of these explosives being applied. They could be what we call conventional explosives. That is, another word for that is molecular explosives, there are many suggestions possible for what kind of explosives they could be used. They could also be thermitic. The point being that the thermite reaction has been the subject of military investigations since the early 1990s. And the energy of the thermite reaction can be converted into a pressure force. That is, you're adding other chemicals to the mix and you're using nanotechnology to make the materials, making them into. And much of this research, obviously, is military and it is secret.
Yeah. Now,
some of the stuff we know how they do this. Yeah.
Yeah.
Eventually.
Now, I want to get there, and I want to make sure we covered that as well. We're going to take a break here in a few minutes or so here, Niels. I want to talk about your website, give out the addresses, and where people can go and find out more about your work. But just one question I want to sneak in there before we do that. Do you have any idea of how it would be applied in the buildings? And could this be done weeks in advance, months, the same day? Do we have any ideas of how it would be applied inside of the buildings?
Well, if time permits, I have a suggestion where the nanothermite actually fits in.
Yeah.
Will we have time for that, or are we going into...
No, let's do that. Let's cover that before we take a break. Definitely. Let's go there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because if you care to watch again the collapses of the Twin Towers, you'd see all the objects being hurled out of the building has a white smoke trail after them. And this is very uniform. And some of the objects is actually accelerating towards the ground faster than free fall. Some of the objects are making twists and turns. Some of the objects are actually making a 90 degrees turn when coming out from the building. David Chandler has made a very good work and looking at these videos, and it's on his website. And the white smoke trail, they follow the objects closely, so when the object is twisting and turning, so does the smoke trail. Now, the white smoke trail is not smoke from the fires, and it is not pulverized concrete, neither is it pulverized gypsum, because there was wallboard in abundance in the building. That's one thing. But it's uniform, it's coming from the objects. This, in my opinion, in my suggestion, this is hypothesis, but now we are into the guessing part of the story. My guess is that this is the nanothermite at work, because I told you that one product of the thermite reaction is elemental iron, but the other one is aluminum oxide, and that is white. So whenever, and there are many reports of white smoke coming out from the towers. Actually, prior to the collapses, there are white smoke coming out of the base of the towers. There are white smoke coming out of the windows. There are white smoke following the all the objects being hurled out from the collapse of the Twin Towers. And that, I believe, is aluminum oxide. And that, I believe, this is the nanothermite at work. This is what I believe. Why they're doing it this way, we can speculate. But maybe we shouldn't do that. Maybe we should.
Well, are you suggesting that there would have been a better or more efficient way of doing it?
Yeah, let gravity do the work. Why do they have to hurl the objects out and away from the towers? Why not let the whole thing collapse downwards?
Yeah, I don't know. It's a good question. Maybe we are in the territory of some sort of psychological impact, if you will, that they're after. Not that it would not be dramatic enough with the tower falling down, but the way it did happen now with this, as you say, explosion and dissemination of all the dust from everywhere. I mean, it looks like a smoking chimney. I mean, it just explodes out. It's incredible.
Yeah, that is one option, simply for visual impact.
Yeah. All right.
Let's take a
little break and continue here in a little bit. I want to give out your website as well, Neil, so people know where to go to read more about you. And if there's any other websites you want to give out, I know that you talked before we got on here about the 9/11 Consensus Project. So please go ahead and mention that as well if you want to.
No, I don't have a website. I'm not on Facebook. You know, I have so much correspondence already without a website and a Facebook site, so this would simply suck up all my time if I did that. So
well, how about your .org website, yourname.org? That's your website, right?
Yeah, I think this is somebody who has set that up for me.
Oh, okay. I haven't seen it for a year.
I don't know what's happening there.
All right, but the paper is linked up there anyway.
Somebody else, some Danes have set up a Facebook page for me.
Well,
and actually, they're doing a pretty good job. but the other one, NilsHarry.org, you know, I haven't seen it for a year. I don't know what's going on.
Well, there's videos there, video interviews. The paper is linked up from the university and everything else. So I do recommend people going there because it's a quick and easy access to some of your material. And we're going to have that linked up, of course.
Okay. If you think it's nice, you would.
Well, that sounds good. And then we're going to link up later the Consensus 9/11 Consensus Project as well, and we might get into talking a little bit more about that, Niels. But let's take a short break right here, then we'll carry on with more in just a bit. So stay with us, and we'll be right back.
Some people's high, some people's cold, some people's not very swift to be home. Some people do it. Some see right through it. Some wear pajamas if only they knew it. And the pajama people are boring me to pieces. Feel like I am wasting my time. They all got flannel up and down on them, a little trapdoor back around on them, some cozy little footies on their mind. Pajama people. Pajama people, they sure do make you sleepy with the things they might say. Pajama people, pajama people, Mother Mary and Joseph, I wish they'd all go away. Pajama people, it's a pajama people special. Take one home with you, save a dollar today. Pajama people, pajama people, people. Pull them out, get them out of my way.
Hey, 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 hey,
hey. Hoy, hoy, hoy. Get them out of my way.
Hey, 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 hey. never know the way. Get them out of my way.
Get them out of my way.
Out of my way.